student. He mentioned he knows me as a student, but I'm the student. Today I've been asked to speak a little bit about the Robin Hood dilemma, taking the law into your own hands. And I'm going to speak for a few moments on the aspect as an attorney, and there's certain things that we come across in our lives regarding self-help or taking the law into our own hands. When asked to deal with the topic, the first thing I thought about was civil disobedience, which is the refusal to obey a governmental law generally based upon one's own moral conviction. Now, we all know that Henry David Thoreau wrote the famous essay on the subject, which was first published 160 years ago, in 1849. Thoreau argued people should not allow their government to enact laws which override their moral convictions. People have an actual duty, an affirmative duty, to induce the government to change such immoral or unjust laws. It's been said that the motivation behind Thoreau was his disdain for slavery and the principles which were fought for in the Mexican-American War. Now, I myself, as a young man, I recall the Vietnam War protesters, where you had the construction workers and the hippies hitting each other over the heads. And that unrest, civil unrest, was highlighted in the movie Forrest Gump, very popular film, Forrest Gump. The protests certainly could be characterized as acts of civil disobedience. I myself, while attending college in the mid-70s at University of Denver, remember outside of Denver proper, the Rocky Flats nuclear plant, and they were dumping the waste products in the streams of Colorado, and the musician Jackson Browne, who was friends with the group The Eagles, and Elton John, and those folks would come on a regular basis every week to start protesting and to do whatever they could to disrupt the Rocky Flats nuclear plant. Civil disobedience involves breaking one or more laws to gain attention to the absurdity of certain laws which impinge upon our moral compasses. Now, in examining civil disobedience, it struck me that with the recent BP crisis, I think we call it a crisis, all that oil, can we think of really any overt acts of civil disobedience? Countless sea life were killed. So many people's lives are affected. But I wonder where the acts are of civil disobedience. When gas prices shot up into the $4 to $5 range, where were the acts of civil disobedience? Gas prices were going up to $4 and $5 a gallon. And then at the end of the year, the financials for the oil companies were coming in and they were making record profits, billions and billions of dollars of profits. So it appears that at least in the United States, acts of civil disobedience have gone the way of the cassette tape, obsolete. Perhaps people are too busy on their Blackberries, on their laptops. We're so swamped with we're inundated and deluged with the things of the moment that perhaps we don't have time for civil disobedience. We certainly have the mechanisms and the means to congregate, to get a group together. Over the years, it was difficult for communication, for people to get together and make a plan. Now you have, if a teenager or a college kid wants to throw a party, they can say, we're having a party tonight, and you're going to have 1,000 people show up because they can do the mass text on their cell phone or their BlackBerry or their iPhone. So I just wonder where the acts of civil, and if the BP incident doesn't give rise, coupled with global warming and all else, the BP would seem to give individuals and entities on society the impetus to exhibit civil disobedience. It's just not here. In the law, we know the doctrine of self-help, the legal doctrine referring to an individual or entity's exercise of their own rights without resorting to legal writ or higher judicial government authority. The simple example is the repo of an automobile, self-help on behalf of the finance company, or retrieval of property in the wrongful possession of others, or abating a real property nuisance by erecting barriers, to protect against the nuisance, or erecting a wall to protect against the noise coming from a neighbor's property. The wall might impinge upon the property of another, but you need to exhibit some sort of control because the police are too busy doing something else, or that they're gonna ask for you to file a civil complaint, and you have a headache tonight because of the noise brought forth from the neighbor's property. In general, self-help is okay so long as laws are not broken and no breach of peace occurs. The hiring of a third party to conduct self-help on your behalf does not alleviate that responsibility to avoid a breach of the peace during the exercise of self-help. There was a famous case involving self-help ruled upon by the Texas Supreme Court in 1992. MBank El Paso versus Sanchez. Mrs. Sanchez financed the purchase of a car from MBank El Paso. She defaulted on the loan. So MBank hired a repo company, they're called adjustment companies, to tow the automobile. The wily Sanchez sees them going, so what does she do? She hops in the car, closes the door. But that did not dissuade the tow truck operator, who hoists the car up on the jack with Mrs. Sanchez in tow and tows her to the junkyard and leaves Miss Sanchez there overnight, which only had the junkyard dog literally involved with guarding the junkyard. So Mrs. Sanchez sued for, I guess, wrongful imprisonment and those type of civil remedies, and the lower court ruled in her favor because it was deemed to be a breach of the peace. Towing Mrs. Sanchez and to the junkyard was a breach of the peace. So the Supreme Court upheld, and that case also stood for the proposition that although the action was by the tow truck operator, who was a separate independent contractor and not technically an agent or employee of the bank or the finance company, the bank finance company was held liable. You can't avoid that when you're exercising the doctrine of self-help, that the principal will be held responsible, and in this case, even though it's an independent contractor relationship. In the criminal arena, we're familiar with the case of the state of New York versus Bernard Goetz. I have tried to reach out to Darnay Hoffman, the lawyer who originally represented Bernard Goetz, and he is, I guess, semi-retired, and he's living in a friend's place, and I called his significant other this morning. I wanted a one-liner from Mr. Hoffman on the issue of asserting one's rights on one's own behalf. On December 22, 1984, Bernard Goetz shot four young men while riding on a New York City subway. We all remember that case. Mr. Goetz claimed he thought the men were going to rob him. He was in fear for his life. But there was a split opinion as to whether, in fact, Mr. Goetz was in fear for his life or Mr. Goetz was out there prowling for trouble, whether he was waiting for something. If you ride in New York City, I grew up in the Bronx, and you can probably hear from my accent. I'm a New Yorker, and I rode the subway many times. And if you ride the subway long enough, things are going to happen. I remember when I brought my friends from University of Denver back over spring break to visit New York. We went on the subway, and we went to Yankee Stadium. On the ride back from Yankee Stadium back into Manhattan, there was a gentleman with his eye partly gouged out, holding a knife, running through the crowded subway, being chased by an officer with his gun out. And the guy from Nebraska, Herschel was his name, said, "Look, they're filming a movie." Herschel said, "Look, but..." I said, "Herschel, this ain't no movie. This is New York." Charles Bronson was successful with those films, Death Wish. And to some degree, it reaches everyone's fantasy, every New Yorker, somebody do something about the trouble. So the question was Mr. Goetz, well, one of the questions, was he actually in fear or... was it something more than that? He was dubbed the subway vigilante. You know, what heightened the problem or the issues was Goetz was white. The victims were not. The case was a prominent one. It received national and most definitely international attention. And this was before the days of the Internet, where everything can instantaneously receive international. The repercussions explosive. At the criminal trial, Goetz was acquitted of the serious crimes. He was found guilty for a lesser offense of possessing an unregistered firearm. And he did spend 250 days in jail, a little more than 8 months in jail. And that was, I'm sure, a political situation because every day individuals are convicted of that type of offense and they receive probation. But one of the victims was paralyzed. And in fact, Mr. Goetz was successfully sued in the civil arena, and he opined that he should not be held accountable for seriously injuring anyone during the commission of a crime. So while Bernard Goetz was viewed by some New Yorkers as being a hero, standing up to a crime and dissuading, I mean, the effect of the self-help in this case was that I would think at least one crime was averted. How many lives were saved and how many crimes were averted by a thug or a punk or a criminal thinking twice before hopping on a New York subway? And that doesn't mean to say that individuals should not be, should go around hurting other individuals. However, in the commission of a crime for self-defense, self-defense is certainly a legitimate affirmative defense. So those are some of the issues raised when one takes law into his or her own hands. We learn about the doctrine of self-help in law school, and the key is to maintain the peace and avoid a breach of the peace. And looking where the word self-help originate from, there was a gentleman who lived from 1812 to 1904. His name was Samuel Smiles. So doesn't it say something that the individual who first exercised or conjured up the doctrine of self-help was named Smiles? I think that's a nice thing. And he published the very first self-help book and the first personal development book, and that book was called Self-Help. So you can check out the book Self-Help, published in 1859. And as I close here today, I would say if you look at the opening sentence of the book, it states, quote, "Heaven helps those who help themselves," close quote. So sometimes there's an expression that if you want to get something done, you have to do it yourself. And the key in this regard is to avoid a breach of the peace and to... if you're going to technically break a law, which you should not do, but if you're forced to, then look at the spirit of the law. And if you're not breaking the spirit of the law, then you can certainly exercise your privilege of self-help. So, Lashana Tov again. If anybody has any questions about our discussion,
I wasn't really understanding the BP oil spill. We just there was no civil disobedience. Were you suggesting that would be okay to have civil disobedience regarding the BP oil spill?
Well, I think that it's okay to have civil disobedience about anything that involves what somebody believes to be an immoral or improper position.
Okay, what was immoral about the BP oil spill? That's what I didn't follow.
Okay, well, I think everybody would have their own subjective. I think that, I think you can read the newspapers and glean the arguments being made for the disruption of wildlife in our environment. So there are several acts that occur in our society on a infrequent basis, and certainly there's been arguments made that what occurred was preventable, and some folks assert reprehensible. So for those... the point being that that was a large event, and you don't see acts of civil disobedience for small events. You don't see acts of civil disobedience generally speaking for or when you say you don't see there's not organized acts of civil disobedience. And in regard to I'm certainly not rendering a subjective opinion as to what went on, but what I think is fact is that it was a significant event. And if this occurred in the 60s, there would be protest. Now, I think the difference between protest and civil disobedience would perhaps, for example, I'm certainly not suggesting it, but would be to block trucks from putting their oils into BP stations, doing some act of protest to require government to pass laws to, put safeguards in place so that an event like that, like what has occurred, either would not occur or be less likely to occur. But I certainly wasn't opining on anything against BP or anybody else. It's just a large event, and there seems to be perhaps, and I mentioned the text, the messaging, and there's a decentralization of ideas and of communication, I think, through the internet, and so that was sort of my point.
It sounds like your definition of civil disobedience conflates the concept of protesting with the idea of disobeying a state or federal law. I mean, for example, in the Vietnam era, which you pointed to, the act of civil disobedience that typified that area was burning your draft card, directly disobeying the orders of your government to join the military. So where's the state action in the BP situation where you would disobey the government?
The state action would be to that the lack of regulation upon the oil industry. So that would be the act of, would be that there's insufficient legislation that, and the easing of restrictions, because there were at times various environmental restrictions. So the governmental action you're seeking to have come into play would be the imposition of tighter regulations, watchdog safeguarding. The specific question would be better asked for like Greenpeace than myself. I just use that as an example.
That seems like the precise.
I just
need
to take questions at the end for the whole program. Move on to the next, if that's possible, because I don't want to disrupt the kind of the program. To take questions at the end of the whole program, addressed to the two speakers respectively. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Rosen, for the presentation. I found it quite interesting. Also remember the Bernard Goetz case well, because I'm also from New York. I rode more the city buses than the trains, but nonetheless, that's not the topic of our discussion today, but there we have a clear ruling from the Torah itself that someone comes to attack you, absolutely permissible to defend yourself, even if it means killing the person. Even if he comes to try to sneak in to try to steal your money, the Torah says also you can protect yourself even to the point where you can injure the person, and if injuring him will not help, you can even kill the person. And that's because you could safely assume, we assume, that if he's trying to steal my money and if I defend myself, then he would be out to kill me. And if a person is out to kill me, I can then kill him first. That was in terms of that case. But I'd like to focus more on cases of damage where we're not trying to kill anyone, but also in the area of self-help, the area of when can I take the law into my own hands, and when perhaps don't I have to go through the trouble of getting the law involved, and whether the law means the court system, or suing, or whether the law means even just getting the police force involved. So let me just present three scenarios, And then we'll learn together, we'll study together two passages here in the Talmud and see if we can glean from that the answer to these three scenarios. We're not here in debate, we're just here in contrast in terms of what the legally, what would in the American law system, what the justice system in American law would say on the matter, and on the other hand, what the Torah would say on the matter. How when there's a conflict, that's a separate discussion to who wins out. And at times, the law of the Torah will win out, and at times, the law of the land will win out. And the Torah gives us guidelines for that as well. So scenario number one is like this. A person is legally parked on the street, let's say here in Philadelphia, and a taxi cab comes and double parks in front of your parked car. No driver in the car, but you see just on the corner is a little taxi stand. So you go over and you say, "Excuse me, I noticed one of your cars here are double parked. Could you have someone move it?" "Sorry, we're on lunch break now. Come back in 10 minutes. No, you don't have 10 minutes to waste. And they seemed all to be on lunch break. You don't know whose car it is. You obviously not going to go in and take somebody's keys and move the car. So you go out, you pick up your cell phone, you look at the number, you dial the number. You say, "I'd like to order a taxi cab for somewhere four blocks down." And sure enough, 60 seconds later, somebody finishes his lunch break, comes out to the car, and goes four blocks down, obviously to pick up nobody, because nobody's there, and you take your car out. Did you act in accordance with the law from a halachic standpoint? Was that permissible to do? You were helping yourself, you were defending yourself. True, you could have called 911, this is not an emergency, but and you could have waited, and it wouldn't have been 10 minutes, probably would have been 30 minutes before you get your car out. So, to save yourself that trouble, was it okay to do that and sort of fool the person saying that you want a taxi at that place? That's scenario number one. Scenario number two. Somebody parks his vehicle at the close enough to the front entrance of your building, where if you want to get out, it'll be very difficult to open the door, and there are other people in the building who will be exiting this door, and almost surely, the way they open the door in full, it will dent this person's car, scratch this person's car, and you notice that. You could put up a sign saying, "Open the door slowly," and then have everybody go out very gingerly and carefully. Or you could put up a sign, "Don't use this exit now," and everyone has to go around and use the back exit. What are you allowed to do in that case? Can you just have everybody go out the regular way and they'll open the door in full, it'll be easy to get out, and it's almost it's assured that the person's car will get dented. That's the second scenario. What is a person allowed to do? In the first case, action was taken. We want to know if it was permissible. The second case is, what are the options for the person? Does he have to go now use the back door for who knows how many hours the person will be there? Or can he just use the door freely, exit and enter, even though damage will be caused to this person's car? And finally, this third scenario, which we'll see is quite related, and that is, you have outside your house in your backyard a little tomato patch, which you tend to very carefully on the weekends. And the neighbor's dog, the nuisance that he is, keeps jumping over the fence and chomps on my tomatoes. And I tell the person, "Could you keep your dog?" And he says, "What can I do? You know, he's running around. I can't leash him down." And this happens once, twice, three times. What am I to do? So, one friend tells me, "Well, just build a tall fence around the tomato patch." Well, I could do that. It'll cost me a few pennies, but maybe that's what I have to do. My other friend says, "I'll tell you what to do. Just buy some of that poison and sprinkle it on some of the tomatoes. You won't have the problem from the dog anymore." Can I take that course of action? Is that permissible to poison the dog who keeps eating from my tomato patch. Those are the three scenarios. Clear? Okay. So now let's, as we said, let's study a passage here in the Talmud. Quite a graphic case. The Talmud starts with, this is in the Tractate Bava Kamma, which deals with tort law, with damages. And here's a case of two people who owned a well. And they drew water from the well to irrigate their fields, perhaps to feed their family. And each day they took a turn. And there was a certain amount of water in the well that can be drawn up each day. And this way they split it. Each one drew enough water for a two-day period. So it was a well belonging to two persons. It was used by them on alternate days. One of them, however, came and used it on a day that was not his turn. The other party comes along with his bucket in hand and is ready to draw water, and he sees his friend there. He says, hey, this is my day. What are you doing here? The first person paid no attention to him. He ignored his friend. He ignored his partner. So the person whose day it was took the blade of a hoe and he struck the person with it. In other words, that was the only way he was going to get him away. He used physical action to get the person away. He wasn't listening to him. He wasn't listening to his cries, to his pleas. He actually physically hurt him in order to stop him. And Rav Nachman, upon hearing this, commented. He says, it wouldn't have been all that bad had he had to hit him 100 times also. In other words, he sanctioned this action. So, according to Rabbi Nachman, he sanctioned this action of using physical strength to get a person to stop stealing from me. The Talmud then says this really gets into a broader discussion. And this discussion is, can a person take the law into his own hands? And here, in this case, where there would be a certain loss to the person who was rightfully able to draw water that day. And it's explained by the commentaries, that's because if the first person would be drawing the water, I would either have no water left to draw that day, I would lose out the water to be able to irrigate my field, to have water for my household, or perhaps he would take the amount of water he would take, I would never be able to charge him for that, because I would never be able to have an exact figure as to how much water he took and sort of stole from me. So in the case where there would be an absolute loss to the second individual, the first individual stealing it, so there's no recourse in terms of getting reimbursed over here, I am allowed to take action. That's what the Talmud concludes. The second paragraph gets into a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nachman. What if there's no loss involved, but rather it's just the burden of taking the person to court. I see exactly what he's doing. I see, let's say, his dog is eating from my tomato patch. I have a video camera getting everything recorded on film. All I have to do is then take him to a small claims court, show the video, it's clear as day, I can bring witnesses, and I would have wasted a few days, but I would be reimbursed, and the court would then decide how much I'm to be reimbursed, what the necessary action the owner of the dog is to take, and everything will be okay. Am I allowed to take action myself, or do I have to go through the trouble of getting the authorities involved? And that is deemed to be a dispute. Again, where there's no financial loss involved, it's only circumventing trouble, circumventing a nuisance for myself, a burden on my part to take him to court or to call the police. And that's a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nachman. So everyone can take sides, who you want to hold like, but that's a matter of dispute here in the Talmud. So as is very common, what the Talmud will do when you have a dispute is we'll try to see earlier sources. Let's look at earlier sources and see, do we have any precedent for this question at hand? Can I take the law into my own hands just to avoid a nuisance? Again, not to save myself any money, but just to save myself the trouble of being able to be reimbursed from damage that can happen or damage that has happened. So here in folio 28a, the Talmud brings what certainly we could say is a bizarre case. but also not uncommon for the Talmud. The Talmud spoke in terms of what was more common in terms of the society, in terms of what type of culture it was, and they understood that what can be applied to the scenarios of a more modern society. So the case here is like this. Come and hear the following case. In the case of an ox throwing itself upon the back of another's ox so as to kill it. Okay? So my friend's ox jumps on my ox and is devouring it, is going to maul it to death. If the owner of the ox that was beneath arrived and extricated his ox, pretty strong guy, but okay, he pulled out his ox. Perhaps we could exchange an ox for a teacher who sees two students and one's on top of the other, banging him. What can be done in that case? But let's deal with the case of the ox that the Talmud describes here. So the owner of the ox pulls the ox from underneath, and the ox on the above was dropped down and was killed in that case. The owner of the ox at the bottom is exempt from paying. He's not liable for that case. In other words, he just pulled his own ox out, the top ox fell down, somehow got killed, does not have to pay for the damages for the dead ox. Now, does this ruling apply to a mu'ad where no irreparable loss is pending? Okay, so just let me tell you a quick rule, and that is that if this ox was known to be stalking other oxes and pouncing on them and killing them, so it is considered a mu'ad, which means that is a three-time offender of killing other oxes, and in that case, I would be able to be reimbursed in full for my ox. Had the top ox indeed killed my ox, I would be reimbursed in full. What does that tell me? That tells me that I have no financial loss here involved. I would be able to be reimbursed in full for the damage that has occurred. Nonetheless, it seems to say that I could still take action and take the law into my own hands. Says the Talmud, no, that's not the case. I could say the case only applies to a tam, which means that this is only a first-time offender, this ox, and therefore if indeed the top ox killed the bottom ox, how much would I be reimbursed? Half. Very good. Evan, a Talmudic scholar and student, knows the answer. Half. Which means over there, I certainly would be incurring a loss if I don't take action. And like we said before, if there will be a certain loss and I will not be able to be reimbursed, can I take action? Can I take the law into my own hands? The Talmud says indeed, yes. But when the case is where I will not incur a loss, again, I'm just going to have to go through the trouble of bringing this fellow to court and say, his ox killed my ox, I want to be reimbursed in full. Can I take action or not? But then the Talmud says, but there's a slight change to the case where indeed the owner of the victimized ox will be penalized. And the Talmud continues, but if so, read the subsequent clause. If the owner of the ox that was beneath pushed the ox from above, which was thus killed, there would be liability to compensate. Now, if the case is dealing with a tam, which means if I would be reimbursed in either case, so then I should be able to take action because there's an absolute loss involved. So why can't I take action by pushing the ox off? Why is it only that I must extricate my ox from underneath? What's the difference? And says the Talmud, since he was able to extricate his ox from underneath, which in fact he did not do so, he had no right to push and directly kill the assailing ox. So this is a very fine line difference of what the Talmud expects of a person. But like we mentioned before, if someone is attacking me, the Talmud requires me that if I could just stop him by injuring him and not killing him, I will be obligated to do that. And if indeed the person does kill his potential assailant, where it certainly understood and assessed that he could just injure him to prevent him from killing him, he would be liable. So here too, it seems very clear that even when I am allowed to protect myself, I'm allowed to self-help myself by taking the law into my own hands, what do we see from this Talmud, this statement over here? We see that I must try to have the most minimal amount of damage incurred to the other person. That's clear. I can't push the ox off. I can only extricate my own ox from underneath. And that's clear from over there. So that's point number one. Point number two is we'll read the final passage in the Talmud, and then we'll get back to our three scenarios, and hopefully we'll be able to glean the answer from these cases here. One final case coming here. In the case of a trespasser, having filled his neighbor's premises with pitchers of wine and pitchers of oil. You come home one night, and your neighbor unloaded all of his or her groceries across your driveway. Several boxes and bags of groceries. Why she left it over there or he left it over there, who knows? She stopped her car there and figured it would be easier, and then she left and left them in your driveway. And you come home with your car. You want to get into your driveway. What if you have no parking space on the street? Only you can get into your driveway. What are you allowed to do? What are you entitled by law to do?
Push it out of the way.
So can I just drive in and the considerable amount of the groceries will be ruined and there will be a loss incurred by this person who put it there? But nonetheless, it was my right of way and they had no right to it. Trespassing, they had no right to put it over there.
There was no other reasonable way to do it.
Oh, sure, I can get out of my car and lug away all the boxes to the side and all the bags to the side and then drive in. Am I required to do that? And here the Talmud says very clearly that I am not. If I wanted to, if I was, did not have the time or the will to go through that trouble, I'm not obligated. I am certainly allowed to, and if I want to keep good ties with my neighbor, it probably would be the wiser way to go. But in a case where a person was hasty or a person did not want to go through that trouble, the Talmud says like this. The owner of the premises is entitled to break them when going in, going out, and break them when coming in. And therefore we would prove from here that indeed a person can take the law into his own hands, and even when there's not a loss of damages here. That's the conclusion of the Talmud over here. Question. Oh, I was going to ask a question. I wasn't opening the question to the floor. Oh, but I'll let you go first, and then I'll ask my question.
Okay, because I think I know the answer. Well, I was just wondering, in the first scenario where the man, you know, used the axe to protect his water rights, let's say there was a water well somewhere else that he had to travel, would he be obligated to try to find another solution?
Well, it would seem from this case over here, right, that you're not obligated to do so. So that's almost the question that I was going to ask by the commentator, one of the famous commentators on the Talmud, the Tosfos, lived approximately 800 years ago. The Talmud was written approximately 1,500 years ago, redacted. The question is like this: why in the case of the ox am I obligated to only extricate my ox, pull them out from underneath, and not push off the top ox? Yet, by the case of all the neighbor's groceries, I'm not obligated to get out and move out all the groceries. And I think the difference is obvious. What's the difference?
Be compensated.
Oh, but let's put that aside. You're right. The Talmud made that distinction. But assuming that wasn't the difference.
The ox is alive.
Okay.
Well, in the first case, there's imminent danger. In the second case, you haven't driven in and out yet. So there is the imminent... action must be taken in the first scenario. Action need not be taken necessarily in the second scenario.
True, true. And yet it seems to say that Talmud says, I'm not obligated to move away all of those boxes of groceries, and I could drive straight in and then drive out again. But yet, by the case of the ox, where I do have to take action, it seems I have to take action which then will have minimal damages occurring to the assailing ox. Why is there a difference? So the Tosfos make the following distinction. True, I have to take action, but I have two options. I could either push off the top ox, which is more probable that he would get damaged or killed. Okay, let's assume that I'm using either a rope or some sort of tool that I'm pushing him off, or I can pull out my own ox, where there's a lesser chance that the top ox would be damaged or killed. In the case, it happened to be that in either case, the ox did get killed. But when I did what was most minimal damage possible, then I'm exempt. And when I pushed the top off ox, where that was a more probability that the ox would get killed or damaged, there I am liable. So we see from that case that I'm required to take the minimal amount of damage that will occur. I'm required to calculate that if I have the presence of mind to do so. But in that case, either way, I'm exerting energy, either pulling or pushing, but I'm exerting a certain amount of energy. In that case, the Talmud says, you're exerting energy, pull instead of push, and then less damage will occur. However, if I don't have to exert any energy at all, I could just drive right through, and then I'm right at my door with my car parked always where it always is, and I didn't bother moving the groceries out of the way, I'm not required to do that. To get out of my car and then have to go through the effort of moving the boxes away, not required to do that. Bags of groceries, say, it's not too much of a bother. Let's say, as the Talmud says, the big barrels of wine, you know what I don't have to go do? I have to then either go hire some workers, I have to go get my push cart from the garage and start lugging each one of the way just to get into my driveway. You're not required to do that. Just drive in, and whatever collateral damage will happen, you don't have to worry about that. Okay.
What if it's a tricycle?
Tricycle, you're saying, is really effortless. If it's effortless, you're right. It would seem that then I am obligated that no damage should occur.
Put the ox instead of the groceries. There's an ox. Your neighbor's ox now is in the driveway.
Yeah.
And you want to get it. So you're saying you can ride over the ox or hit the ox and hopefully he'll move.
Let's hold that question, and I'll tell you why it's different. Okay?
Maybe you honk your horn, and the ox moves.
Or charges you, maybe.
Right. Right. Assuming, let's say, you honk your horn, and it just keeps wagging its tail. Oh. Yes, question here.
In the ox scenario, suppose you believe it is more dangerous to pull your ox out than push the top ox off.
Yeah, that would make a difference. Yeah, we're giving assumptions over here. We're giving assumptions that you shoot the top ox in the head, you know that certainly will kill him, as opposed to if you extricate your own ox. Yeah.
It seems to me that it's like eye for an eye type situation. Like, as long as somebody infringes on your rights, then you've got a right to, you know, based on the Torah, to go ahead and infringe on theirs. As long as you don't have to make an effort. Like, I thought that Torah would hold you to like a higher standard, that even if somebody is infringing on your rights, you would have maybe a little bit more of an obligation to do something to minimize. Like, I understand it's saying minimize the damage where you can, but it seems that as long as you have to put any effort into it, you're kind of limited in what the effort that you have to put into it. Like, shouldn't there be a little bit of a higher standard? Rabbi?
We are saying that, so this is a matter of disagreement. You're right. I think you feel more like that Rabbi Yehuda is correct. That if all I'm going to have to do is then go through the trouble of making him pay for any damages that happened to me, and I could be reimbursed, that's what I should have to do so. And we're saying that there's the position here of Rabbi Nachman, which the halacha does follow, the code of Jewish law does record the second opinion, that if someone is infringing on my rights where it makes a difference to me at this moment, either a loss of time or a loss of money, that I would not be obligated to go beyond the letter of the law to try to avoid damaging him, unless there's a way I can do that. So that's what we're trying to depict, how much that is. We see by the ox there's a difference in I have to exert effort and energy, but I have to do it from the bottom instead of the top. And yet by the cases of the barrels, let's say that's a significant amount of effort, I'm not required to do that.
But there's got to be more examples other than just these, right?
There are other examples, but these are the paradigms, so we could just use these as the models.
It just seems harsh. I think she's right. It seemed to me very harsh that would be the result. You could just ride over those groceries to get in your garage. I mean, there should be some, like, gulp it down, things happen, standard, where, you know, there's adverse things that happen to you. It doesn't mean you strike out and do more damage.
Well, I think that there's a lot of assumptions that need to be made. For example, I think in that example, you have to assume that the person has somewhere to be. Like, they don't have... I mean, you're putting a strong onus on somebody to have to move wine and packages. I mean, all things considered, if you add factors like it's a time they have nothing to do with the rest of the day and they're all by themselves, they're looking for something to do, but to require maybe somebody, to make a mandate, a halakhic mandate, requiring somebody, that's a strong thing to mandate.
It doesn't feel right to me. I couldn't see doing that damage. I would suck about it.
One question I had would be, let's say you have the wine and the oil there. Rather than drive through it, I look at the wine, I think, I call up 9 of my friends, we have a minion, and we drink the wine. You would think that if you have the right to break it, you have the right to consume it. Now, if you drove through it and broke it, if that person brought a claim, halachically, they would lose, correct?
Correct.
Okay, now what if we drank the wine and we consume it? Now we enjoy the benefit of the wine and we enjoy the benefit of the oil. And they say, well, now you actually enjoyed the benefit of this and they brought a claim.
They would be paid in full.
They would be paid in full.
Yeah.
And what's the difference?
You drank his wine. It was his wine. You decided to drink it. You decided to not use your halakhic rights and just draw. What you're allowed to do is, for example, let's go back to the first scenario. Person is double parked, blocking me in, right? So I see some of you would not get hot under the collar. Some of you say, "Oh, yeah, that's all right. I'll just tell my boss I was 10 minutes late because there was a taxi blocking me in, and I'm just wanted to be a good citizen. Didn't want to, it wasn't 10 minutes, it was 20 minutes. Oh, but that's okay also." Okay. That's what some of you want to say, and you're entitled to do that. The halakha is explaining what is the extreme action that I may take. Of course, I don't have to drive right over my neighbor's groceries, okay? But we're assuming, what if the person is pressed for time and he has an important meeting to go to, or he has to pick somebody up? What is he halakhically allowed to do? So in the first case, is certainly no question that I can't go and let the air out of the tires of this taxi. That doesn't get me anywhere, it's just revenge, and he can charge me for that. So that's why I can't go drink the wine, I can't capitalize on what he did wrong, I can't then be an offender myself, I can't be a thief by stealing his wine. So the first case with a taxi, what I could do is perhaps drive my car out, if my car is bigger than his, I have a Hummer, and I push his car aside, and his car would be damaged in the process. Maybe I could do that. But here, this person thought of a more minimal damage. And what is that? Call the taxi stand and have them send this car somewhere else. So there's minimal damage. They used up, they waste a little time and a little gas. In a normal case, I would have to pay for that. But since I'm allowed to self-help myself, to get myself out of this person who was unlawful, I'm allowed to do that. And in that case, I did right by trying to incur the most minimal damage possible. That was scenario number one. Scenario number two was someone parks right in front of the building. Many people have to go out of this door. You can go through the trouble of going out a different door. Now, that we can debate. How much effort am I required to do? We know I am not required to go stack up all of his barrels of wine and oil on the side of the driveway. That I don't have to do. On the other hand, I am required to do minimal effort when it's talking about pulling the ox as opposed to pushing the ox. So I think that's debatable. Is that considered too much bother to have everybody in the building go out the side door and Or are you allowed to just keep going out the front door even though damage will incur to that car? Perhaps I'm required to call a tow truck. No, tow truck also. It's time, it's effort, it's a police report, writing it down. Am I required to go through that effort? I think that's debatable, and we can leave that up to everyone's imagination. The third and final case, and then we get back to your question with the ox roaming around in my driveway. The third case we gave was that my neighbor's dog keeps coming in and eating from my vegetables. And my question is, am I allowed to take action over there and indirectly cause the dog to go to sleep? And here, one of the great halakhic deciders of about 150 years ago said there's a big distinction in this case. When a person parks his car unlawfully, halakhically, illegally, who is the damager? Who did wrong? The person himself. When the person unloaded their groceries or the barrels of wine in my driveway, who did wrong? The person himself. When the ox roams over to my driveway and parks itself in my driveway, or when the neighbor's dog comes over and is eating from my tomato patch, who's the guilty party? The ox or the dog. Who's ultimately responsible for his ox or his dog? The owner. The owner is responsible to watch it. But that's a lesser degree than he himself doing what was unlawful. What he did unlawful is he didn't protect or watch or guard his animal to the necessary amount that he had to. But since that's a sort of a lesser offense, it could very well be that in that case, we won't be allowed to take action. So where he himself was negligent and unloaded his groceries unlawfully, I can just drive through if there will be considered too much effort. But when his ox roamed away because he forgot to close the fence or didn't close it properly, in that case, to then kill his ox based on that, where he is his offense is to a less of a degree, in that case, I probably would not be able to cause damage or harm or kill his animal. Any questions?
We take questions also to both presenters as well.
Yes.
Somebody else. I'm sorry to go back to that point that I made earlier. Like, it just seems to me like I think I read somewhere that Rabbi Akiva was asked to summarize the Torah, and he said, "Don't do unto others." I think it was Rabbi Akiva that you wouldn't want done to yourself.
Yeah, that was Hillel, the great tzaddik, yes.
Thank you. And
Rabbi Akiva said something similar. He says, love thy neighbor as thyself.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Which is a big distinction between Christianity and Judaism, I think. But anyway.
Okay.
So I guess maybe the general question that I have, and I'm maybe not in mindful of some of the people in this room, is like, in terms of when interpreting halakhic law, like, where do you take the positive commandment versus like the negative or like interpretation, like based on the Talmud? How do they play against each other? Like a prohibition versus like doing a mitzvah, let's say. I don't know if it's beyond the scope of the discussion.
No, I see everybody is a little bit tense about this idea that I'm allowed to take action, which sometimes it would seem, I think I would agree in certain cases, that should be my right, right? If somebody, a thief comes and steals something from me, can I then go and take that back? It's my item. Am I allowed to steal that back, or am I a thief for doing so? What would we say?
Take it back.
Yeah, and the Talmud says, of course I can take it back, right? Now, don't do unto others with it. I wouldn't want him to steal, but he did steal from me. So it's true, I wouldn't want someone to cause me damage when I'm blocking them, but I also wouldn't want the person to block me in. So that we have to have rights as well in terms of how to go about dealing with other people when they wrong me. So that's why the Talmud says, in an extreme case, when necessary, I can even take this action myself. And in order to protect myself, when someone has wronged me, there are times when I'm allowed to do so.
In answer to Simon's question, I think the reason that you're not seeing the kind of public display is because it's happening, it's a different group of people But you are seeing it, for example, I've seen, and I'm not following it that closely, but there's a number of soldiers taking the position that they have sworn to uphold when they enlisted in the service, or serious soldiers. They have sworn to uphold the Constitution. There's evidence, some think, that the President, the Commander-in-Chief, is not an American and is not entitled to hold that office. They have said, based on what we know, we're not going to obey it, and they refuse, in which case they're court-martialed. That's what you see. And then the other thing that I have been seeing, which has not gained any traction, but every once in a while I hear people talk about there's going to be blood on the street. Well, since you can't get enough people even to go to vote, you know, I don't think you're going to have a real riot. But there is some talk. It's squelched quickly. You don't hear any of the major commentators talking about, you know, Rush Limbaugh, when that violence is out of the picture. Whereas in the 60s, it was quite in the picture. And I think that made the difference. And now you have the internet, mainstream media, but you remember the time when, you know, Black Power, etc., violence was very acceptable. And there were philosophical arguments.
Well, I think that one of the trying to be civil disobedience is civil. So the goal, I think, for civil disobedience is peaceful.
Bill Ayers committed murder, please. The man is a disgrace, and he is holding position. He committed murder. That is as violent as you get. Sorry. They blew up buildings. Blowing up things is not peaceful. However, you haven't seen the reaction and the blowback. Nobody's threatening to assassinate Ayers or anything like that. It's not there. I mean, if it was, I would know about it. But I think there's a difference of attitude. And we've had enough of this. And November's coming. That's what's out there. And that's where we're going to do our civil obedience. But in the 60s, Bill Ayers did not say that. Pardon me. This is what gets some people aggravated. There's a double standard out there. A double standard. And I was down at the Glenbeck rally and down at Vista. There is absolutely no talk of racism, bigotry, violence, any of that. Not there. Not there. But all the people on the other side, the Bill Ayers, were violent and gotten away with it.
A brief question. My practice is mostly criminal, and on two or three occasions I've had to defend people who took self-help in which they were the original victims of a crime. Someone cheated me on a watch deal, I gave them cash, I saw them with a satchel with the cash, I walked them on the street, pushed them aside, severely, took cash from them and said, you stole from me, I steal back. The original thief runs immediately to the prosecutors and the police and says, I'm a victim. And I'm stuck in these rather bizarre circumstances of saying, you're really going to prosecute this guy? Are you insane? This guy just ripped him off. He just took his money back. And the prosecutors go, well, we've got a sworn up oath of law. I said, then charge him with a crime. And that particular instance, that's exactly what they ultimately did. They charged the victim with committing the first theft and mine with the second theft. I said, now you're even more crazy. I don't have any perspectives on that.
So again, what was the case was that
one guy had taken a watch and said, I've got a Rolex watch. He sells it to him for $3,000, which is severely underpriced. Turns out to be crap. He confronts the guy in the street with the satchel of cash that he just gave him the $3,000 with and says, no, I'm taking this back from you. That guy goes, wait a minute, I just had $3,000 that I'm claiming for myself. You know, I've just been robbed.
He didn't mug him to get it. He just grabbed it from him.
Yeah. I think it was a little bit more involved than my client would let me know, but that's probably exactly what he did.
Forcibly grabbed it.
Forcibly took it, and then I was stuck with the situation of prosecuting you for getting your money back.
Yeah. Insane.
And ultimately, it didn't work.
Prosecuting him for committing a crime.
But if somebody steals from you, halachically, you're entitled, if you're not breaching the priest, to get your money back.
Right.
The question is, you're the lawyer, and before the guy goes to get his money back, he comes to you and goes, listen, I know that Tony, who just stole $3,000, is going to be walking down the street. Do I have the right to do it? And then you have to counsel him as to what the law says. And the law, you know, as you know, you'll say, well, if you do it, it's at your own peril.
My partner and I relied on the Talmud to convince a jury that our client wasn't guilty of anything.
Tough to do, right?
Actually, it was a lot easier than I thought.
Oh, good. Okay.
I don't know if they'll let you bring the Talmud in.
We just stacked the jury with people who were probably Bernard Goetz's jury.
When I first became an attorney, I moved to Philadelphia. I was told that one of the greatest trial lawyers was A. Charles Bruto Sr. So I sat in on one of his trials. And in his closing, he grabs the Bible. And, you know, he starts preaching to the jury about the Bible and citing biblical passages in the Bible. And the DA, I object, sustained. And he preaches about the Bible, object, sustained. And so afterwards, I caught him outside the courtroom. And, you know, I was just graduating law school. I just took the bar. I don't even know if I was admitted yet. It was sort of my beginnings of practice. And I said, I had a question for you. And I said, you know, you kept preaching, you're quoting from the Bible, and it's not permissible. He goes, so what? The jury hears it. The judge tells them to disregard it, but they hear it. And so maybe quoting from the Talmud might be something a litigator can use.
All right. I think that was a good plug, Rabbi Coleman, for the CLEs. Yes. They got more Talmudic knowledge. Yes.